Okay, we're now going to have questions by board members of staff. Okay, folks, that's it for the public testimony cards. I'm not going to be accepting any more after this moment. We have about 56, so if everyone was to get 3 minutes, that would push 3 hours alone. So I may cut the time down a little bit, but I want to see where we end up with our prepared presentations first. Okay, this is the time for the board to ask any questions of staff, of staff's presentation. Any board member questions? Okay, Mr. Jeffries.
Thank you. I don't know which staff member, but I'll just read these off. On the slide number 29 that talks about impacts of nitrate pollution, and it showed different cities and so forth, where did that information come from that gave the cost? And was that cost strictly for nitrates, or was that for other contaminants as well? What staff member handled that? Matt? Oh, okay.
Through the chair, while we're waiting, can we also ask questions on the ag order that were not part of the presentation? Or is there another time for that?
You know, I mean, we can. I'm just thinking perhaps we should wait till we've heard from everything, from everybody first.
Sure.
So that'll, I think, help the flow of things, but jot it down. And
okay.
We'll get to it in the end.
Thank you.
So I can answer your question, Mr. Jeffries. Is this the slide you're referring to?
Yes.
Here. So on the left side here, the public drinking water wells, the cost to King City and Salinas, those numbers are based upon our discussions with the water purveyor, Cal-Am Water. So this is not for the entire cities of King City and Salinas, but those wells that.
My question was, is this cost directly related to nitrates in the water?
Yes.
Directly,
yes.
Okay.
These are wells going out of production or requiring treatment because of a nitrate exceedance and a violation.
Okay. Part B of my question, it just a little bit further down, says Monterey County Elementary Schools. Is that all of county schools?
No, that's one school in San Lucas.
One school. What school was that?
San Lucas Elementary School.
I didn't hear you.
San Lucas Elementary.
San Lucas. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's way up the valley. All right. And then my next question is, I don't know what slide it was, but it dealt with the nitrates in Old Salinas River Channel. I think
Karen touched
that. I wasn't challenging that, but did say something about Elkhorn Slough. And the report was, I believe, you showed from 1988 and 1996. You didn't show anything since then because there's been considerable improvement in the Elkhorn Slough on nitrates because of the Elkhorn Slough Foundation buying the property around the slough.
The nitrate is being pulled in on the incoming tides from the Old Salinas Channel, and it's going up into the slough.
Okay.
I have some data showing extremely low oxygen in some of the shallow areas off the main channel. So it is having problems associated with nutrient enrichment.
But you don't have a report since 1996.
The data I showed before this slide was all collected recently, either through our program or the ag program.
Was that included in the graph that was included in the Old Salinas River Channel? Was that all included?
Yeah, this graph on this particular slide goes through 2011. This is from
I saw that, but I thought that was pertaining to the old Salinas River channel itself and not the Elkhorn Slough.
That's true, this is. They have similar probes up in the slough as well. That's how they've been able to put this story together, that the nitrate plumes are coming up on the incoming tides.
Okay. My next question is probably to Michael Thomas, and he talked about the amount of people that's been working on this ag order. My question is, if the board approved this ag order today, would you have enough staffing to be able to mandate and to enforce the order?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
And still do all the rest of the business that the board does?
Yes, we would. The way we've designed this order and the online enrollment database, we now have a database that is designed to be able to manage the problem as it exists. And we're bringing this program in line with the board's other programs. For example, we have our underground tank program, which has far more responsible parties than we have in the ag program. In the underground tank program, there are approximately 6,000 cases. And we manage those cases through a database system that's similar to what we have created for the ag program. And we're bringing this program, we're modernizing it and bringing it in line with several of our other programs. So, yes, the way that it is designed today, we will be able to manage it far more effectively than in the past.
Okay. That's all the questions I have.
Okay. Mr. Johnston?
Yeah, a couple questions. One for Karen. I'm looking at slide 32, toxicity in California waters. It talks about the highest percentage of toxic sites statewide in California Central Coast streams, 56% of Region 3 sites are toxic, 22% of Region 3 sites are highly toxic. So just so I understand, are these sites throughout the region, or are these sites concentrated in the impacted parts of these watersheds where we are really expecting to find the problem and we're looking for the problem?
That's a good question. There's several sets of data. So they basically pulled all the data sets they could together. And so the ag data is in there, our data is in there, and there's several research programs that are in there. Our data tends to not focus only on heavily impacted areas, but the ag data does. And then there's a couple of other data sets, and some of that research was done in agricultural areas. There was an urban study also that looked at urban areas throughout the state. So it's a mix of data sets, and obviously that can affect a percent type calculation.
So it's a mix of data sets. Would it be safe to say it's skewed to the heavily
impacted
areas?
Yeah, it probably is. Yeah. It's expensive to do, and so you tend to do it where it's higher risk. Yeah.
And the other question is for Matt. And you talked about the blurring of well locations for the groundwater monitoring, and that would essentially not reveal the location of the well, just the general area. Does that also mask the identity of the well owner or operator who's reporting? Maybe it wasn't Matt.
Yeah, that's a question for me. So we did talk to our council about that, and yes, both the location and the identity of the well, because the identity of the well could be used to locate it. So both of those would be exempt from public disclosure.
So if an individual farmer is reporting groundwater data, there will be what will be public data will be the general area of the well, but what will not be public data is either the specific location of the well or the identity of the individual farmer who's reporting the data. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Jordan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think these are for Mr. Thomas. I kind of like the end of the report wrap-up, and I just want some clarification in terms of of what I heard in some of the testimony up till now, and that was one that the process leading to the 2004 waiver was deemed a collaborative process. Would you generally agree with that?
It was a collaborative process among a very small group of people, a small group of select stakeholders. It did not include all the stakeholders, and including those people that were affected by the pollution.
And then Congressman Farr, I think, quickly jumped over the word protect and went right to restoration. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the Porter-Cologne Act specifically starts off with protecting from degradation rather than restoration. And isn't that true?
Yes.
So would you call the 2004 waiver program up to now successful, given that frame of reference?
I think the 2004 order was appropriate. Its level of regulation was appropriate at the time it was adopted based on the information we had then. Given the data that we have, it is not appropriate to continue to regulate this issue with that kind of order, with the same level of requirements that are in it. So at the time, I think that was an appropriate order. Today, with the information we have, I don't think it's appropriate.
Okay. And then I had one other question on SIPs, and can, because they've been referred to a couple times through the staff presentation, but can those be implemented during the term of a waiver program?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Question I have is on page 17. I think Karen put this slide up. I think it's the estuary, but I just wanted to find out how close to the ocean. On page 17, it says Santa Maria River, percent of samples toxic, and there's a, yeah, that one. Where's that taken?
What is it, like half a mile from the ocean? Less than half a mile from the ocean.
Okay, and does the arrow point to the sampling station?
Right.
For that data?
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the ocean you can see in the background.
All right. Okay, Mr. Delgado, then Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. I believe it was Senator Cannella's representative that expressed a concern of confusion about the tier percentages and the acres, and he referred to his own letter of back in 2011 where 13% were in Tier 3, but there were no acreages given then. And I note that that 13% has changed to 3%, perhaps in response to that communication. But my question is, can you give us the reason for the change from 13 to 3 and whether you believe the acreages now and the tier percentages now probably would satisfy Senator Cannella, or I'm just confused because that was a concern he expressed.
So the numbers that we have currently, I absolutely think that those are accurate numbers as reflected here, because those are based upon the information submitted by growers in the electronic notice of intent. So there's two reasons why the numbers changed from previously reported. One was because there was a fundamental change in the order. It went from operations to farms, so we got more specific. So farmers requested that the tiering be based upon the characteristics of individual farms instead of by association of an operation. So, for example, if an operation could have been five farms, all with various acreage, and maybe three of those farms now are only in Tier 3, and the other two went to a lower tier. In addition, at the time of that statistic, we were in the middle of the process of having the growers update their electronic notice of intent. So not all growers were reflected in the electronic database. Some of them were still only in hard copy, and so we were just doing our best guess to estimate those numbers. But primarily it went down because of the change from operation to farm.
Okay. Last month we heard a presentation by Dr. Mark De Los Huertos, and it's been referred to since then. including today. My question is, how much of that proposal is implementable with the draft ag order, were the draft ag order to be approved? So how much overlap is there?
I'd say everything about it is implementable with the exception of the difference in reporting elements. So the order would still require the reporting elements that are in the order. But the coalitions, the audits, the surveys, the technical assistance provided, the types of management practices, the assessing risks of farms, that is all implementable as presented in the ag proposal with the current ag order, or the draft.
My last question, I think it's a great idea the more that we up here see on the ground what's happening and what doesn't make sense, what does make sense, that kind of thing. So it was mentioned today and previously the potential for tours. If such tours were to happen after today, how complicated is it to modify the order in ensuing years when we learn by trying to implement it that there's better ways of doing pieces of it?
Mm-hmm. Tours are certainly possible. We've done them before. We can arrange them again in the future. If a quorum of board members goes on a tour, we would have to public notice that. And we've done that before, so we can do it. As far as modifying the order, the board can modify the order at any time or schedule a hearing, direct staff to schedule a hearing to modify the order at any time.
And how, I mean, it's been very complicated to get to where we are today, so how many months does it take for this board to modify?
So far, the indication that we have so far is 3.5 years.
But that's for a wholesale revision, right?
Yes, I was being witty there. If the board had a specific change they wanted to make to the order, I think that could be done in a reasonable amount of time. As you know, our board meetings are scheduled out throughout the year, approximately 6 meetings per year. And so if the board decided that they wanted to make a change to the order, we could schedule it out a few months and present the proposed changes to the board.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Hunter.
Thank you. We heard from elected officials this morning and their representatives the concerns that they have for economic impacts. And so I wanted to get some clarification from you on the staff report, which starting, I think, on page 16 and 17, that notes some of the differences in the cost analysis that was submitted in the alternative proposal submitted by the ag community. And I also note that staff is not able to clearly say who's represented in that alternative plan, so that is something I'm interested in. But the question I have for you right now is, it seems that in the staff discussion, there are some gaps between what costs were included in the analysis conducted by the ag plan versus the costs that you lay out, which include the cost of implementing practices. So can you make that clear for me so that I'm sure that I understand what that says? It seems like we've been giving two different sets and comparing the bottom line only without really knowing.
So both proposals, the primary cost to implement is for management measures. So the individual cost of management measures for a farm depends on that farm, and that's hard for us to predict without, obviously, the farms are very unique.
Right.
So those costs should be similar between the ag proposal and compliance with the draft order and management measures that would be implemented under the draft order. The written economic report or cost report that we received did not appear to include actual estimates of costs to for implementing management practices. It estimated costs for the administrative arrangement of the third-party group and the activities that the third-party group would provide in terms of audits and that kind of activity. Subsequently, they estimated some costs. They attempted to estimate some costs for management measure implementation, used tier three type requirements, and in our opinion, overestimated the application of those tier three requirements to all farms when there are only subsets of farms that would have to implement those various tier three requirements.
Thank you. I also understand that by not including the management practices, it leads to the idea that the alternative plan would actually be a lower cost implementation process. But if you consider the management practices as part of the kind of fundamental cost of all farms coming into compliance, then we're talking about a higher cost, actually, where coalitions may actually, or the third-party option may actually add to the cost. Am I getting that right?
Yes. Okay. That's what we concluded in the staff report, that it's essentially apples and oranges if you're only going to compare costs of the administrative costs in one proposal to the implementation costs in another proposal.
Thank you.
Okay. Looks like that concludes our questions of staff on the presentation. Let's move to our prepared presentations. And we'll start with the Ag Working Group and Farmers for Water Quality. They have 1 hour to give us their presentation.
I'm not sure exactly who it is. So.
And maybe you can ask them how much they want to.
Good.
And Tess, how much do you have an idea of how much time you want to reserve for the end?
Okay.
So we could put the clock for 55 and then.
Do you want us to help you with the clock?
That would be great. Thank you.
Okay. Ready? Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chairman Young and fellow board members. My name is Abby Taylor Silva, and today I represent the Grower Shipper Association of Central California and Farmers for Water Quality, a collaborative that includes my organization, Western Growers, the California Strawberry Commission, the Grower-Shipper Association of Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo Counties, and the Farm Bureaus of Monterey, Santa Cruz, San Benito, Santa Clara, and San Luis Obispo Counties. Today you'll also hear from Carrie Fisher of California Farm Bureau Federation, representing the Ag Working Group, which is made up of all farm bureaus in the region, the other groups I just mentioned, and many more agricultural groups. You'll also hear from Tess Dunham on behalf of Farmers for Water Quality. Our presentation will provide a response to staff's representation of their report and how, at times, it contradicts the report's written word. We will provide for recommended changes to the September 1 draft order and draft MRPs, tier comparisons of the draft order and the ag alternative, and a case for the legality of the ag alternative.
Okay.
Yes?
Can you slow down just a touch and speak up a little bit louder?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Let me get this to my height. Okay. Some have said that agriculture hasn't been engaged. On the contrary, following the dissolution of the ag panel, agriculture's interest in finding a solution has only increased. In addition to submitting a proposal for the most comprehensive, robust irrigated lands coalition in the state and arguably the nation, we reached out to the Packard Foundation last spring to facilitate a dialogue with environmental community leaders. We agreed that we all wanted to see water quality improvement on the Central Coast, and we're all similarly interested in ensuring the continued viability of commercial agriculture on the Central Coast. Unfortunately, despite review of many ideas presented by both the agricultural and environmental communities, we were unable to find a solution that we could all agree to. Additionally, we then began working with Dr. Los Huertos in an effort to bring more science and on-the-ground innovation strategies to our original proposal. Although Dr. Los Huertos' written report, his ideas as expressed to you verbally in February, was not allowed admittance into the record, for the past 2 months it has been public, and we've actively solicited input from all stakeholders, including agriculture, the conservation, scientific, and environmental communities. Our solution-oriented focus has not dimmed. Today you'll hear more about why we believe ours is the best option in meeting our mutual goal of improving water quality. Thank you for providing us the time to speak to you today. Now, Carrie.
Carrie Fisher with California Farm Bureau Federation. I'm going to go over some of the responses to misconceptions that were in the latest staff report and some legal issues that we feel are key to reiterate to you guys today. Approaching misconception one and two regarding if growers are treated the same or differently under the waiver, we agree with staff that yes, growers are treated differently within staff's order. However, there's a key designation with regard to how growers are actually treated under staff's waiver. Growers are treated differently, but the treatment is based on size of operation and not threat to water quality. And if the key of this order, as we've been hearing for the last 3.5 years, is to prioritize on threats to water quality, it seems logical that the treatment of tiers should be on actual threats to water quality and not arbitrary designations and open-ended determinations of size of operation as determined by the executive officer, as I will go into right now. Additional examples of where the staff report contradicts itself are put on your slides. We just pulled out four of them. There's many more. But these right here talk about tiering and how growers will actually be put into different tiers. As you can see highlighted, the executive officer maintains a lot of discretion with regard to where a grower will be placed in a tier and being able to move the grower from one tier to a higher tier. Also, it depends on the definition of operation or farm, and there is conflicting information with regard to what exactly is an operation, what will be categorized as an operation. It's a broad statement that is itself vague and open-ended. The wide discretion that's also given to the executive officer to change who falls within each tier really hampers the ability to come before the board and tell you exactly how many growers will be in tiers 1, 2, or 3. Right now you have staff's estimation. Again, that's an estimation that we don't agree with. And really, you guys will not know until the end of the day where growers fall within tiers 1, 2, or 3. And that will change again throughout, depending on the EO's discretion at any time to move folks. Briefly, for misconception 3, with regard to what was previously talked about, the figures, the 3% versus other percentages that were thrown out earlier, what should be also pointed out that the 3% is just the number of growers, and there's also the 14% figure that is never mentioned, that's kind of put in there in the staff report, and that's the number of acres. And that really needs to be highlighted so folks understand that there is a big difference between the 3% figure and the 14% figure. With regard to misconception number 4 on the draft order not specifying how a grower must comply with the order, we disagree with this statement, and certain examples include paragraph 35, page 19 of the staff order, which says dischargers must implement source control or treatment management practices to prevent erosion, and goes on to talk about treatment and control of stormwater runoff. As you can see, the first line on the bullet point says the words dischargers must implement. This is very specific language that dictates management practices with regard to erosion and stormwater runoff. And the basin plan, your own basin plan, says on page 512, erosion shall be minimized through BMPs. It does not use the word must implement. With regard to page 38, paragraph 38, page 19, the order says discharges must maintain existing naturally occurring riparian vegetation and maintain riparian areas. The basin plan actually uses the language shall be maintained wherever possible. As you can see, maintained wherever possible is very different than must maintain existing naturally occurring and maintain riparian areas. With attachment 2C, page 20, which is the MRP for Tier 3, the staff report dictates that these folks will have to have buffer plans. Growers must submit a water quality buffer plan, which must include the following three bullet points, A, B, and C up there. The requirement of a buffer plan, and we've heard otherwise in the staff report, but the requirement as written in the language in this MRP is a dictation of a management practice. If the true intent of the water quality buffer plan is to protect riparian habitats, the MRP and the order should state this and allow growers the ability to choose the appropriate management practice that's applicable to their tier, whether it be a riparian buffer or something else beneficial for their land. With regard to misconception 5, the draft order requires growers to implement management practices to minimize waste. We disagree with this conclusion, as the draft order contains many provisions that require immediate compliance with water quality standards, even if effective management practices have yet to be developed. On this slide right here, I'll get into more detail. As we heard earlier today, it was told that notwithstanding the fact that the order specifically says must meet water quality standards, staff will not enforce the water quality standards. However, that's not what the plain language of your order says. Additionally, staff put up a slide that showed attachment A and said that attachment A would allow discretion with water quality standard achievements. However, attachment A is not within the order. Attachment A is off the attachment A, I believe it was paragraph 2, which is cited, is a finding provision. It's not a requirement of the order. Additionally, as currently drafted in the order, a third party can come to the board and petition the board to enforce water quality standards on any farmer immediately, as currently proposed in the order. So therefore, the conclusion that has been put forth today that the order's direct language that you must comply with water quality standards doesn't apply is false. With regard to Table 4, and this is on page 38 of the order, there's a table that says milestones. Again, with the interpretation of not having to meet water quality standards, Table 4 is pointed out as this is what folks should achieve in their milestones until they are able to meet their water quality standards. The problem with Table 4 is simply it is a list of milestones. As stated in the staff report, the milestones themselves are not compliance conditions, and they are not enforceable. So therefore, these milestones are not enforceable, and immediate compliance with water quality standards, again as stated in the order, will comply. With regard to misconception 6 regarding growers having to line ponds, we disagree with the statement that this is not a requirement. As you can see pointed out in the language in paragraph 32 and 86, the use of the words must construct and maintain such containment structures to avoid percolation of waste to groundwater is a dictation preventing percolation and the requirement to line a pond. With regard to misconception 7 regarding the use of tile drains within this order as well as staff reports contain information that is conflicting. The draft order previously indicated, and in one place still indicates, that tile drains will be addressed in subsequent orders. In another place in the order, it says tile drains must be in compliance and must meet all monitoring and reporting requirements as any other discharge. So therefore, a grower is left to wonder what do they have to do in order for their tile drains to be in compliance. With regard to misconception 8, the draft order says that 100% crop efficiency is not required. However, if you read tier three discharges, the draft order clearly requires crops in annual rotations to achieve 100% crop efficiency. The exact language is provided for you here. Therefore, we question the determination upon reading bullet A about meeting a ratio target equal to 1, how it does not require the dictation of meeting 100% efficiency. With regard to misconception 10, regarding combining monitoring proposals or combined practices, while the draft order suggests that combined monitoring may be allowed, the cooperative groundwater language, as proposed, provides no opportunity to implement such an option. Further, to support its response to this misconception, the staff report cites a finding of the order rather than an actual provision of the order. To address this, we will actually propose actual revisions to the order a little bit later on in the presentation. With regard to misconception 11, the draft order states that there are not issues with proprietary information and that proprietary information will be protected. While technically we agree with the statement, there is a broader issue that has been passed up. In reality, when you look at the MRP, the reporting requirements for tiers 2 and 3, certain reporting requirements will be reported in a public manner, therefore the information will actually be a public release. In attachment 1B, which used to be referred to as attachment A, additional findings, this document includes 140 findings. However, they do not comply with case law that requires these findings to bridge the analytical gap between the supporting facts and the board's ultimate decision. These findings are merely recitations and summaries of studies and statements made by staff. In order to remedy this, we propose the board not adopt attachment 1B in its current state. A large flaw in attachment 1A, or table 1A, excuse me, in attachment 1B is the use of indicators of narrative objectives within this table. These indicators of narrative objectives are not adopted numeric objectives. Rather, within this order, the indicators have been interpreted and translated into biostimulation objectives. These objectives are not within your basin plan. You have not adopted these. Further, the use of such numbers will conflict with what the state board is currently doing, as they are proposing and currently developing a statewide nutrient policy. In order to remedy this, we propose deleting Table 1A. The order already requires compliance with the basin plan, including those adopted objectives which are within your basin plan. We also suggest deferring to the state board's policy as they are currently going to develop, as I stated already, the nutrient objectives with respect to nitrate levels in surface water. And briefly, we would also just mention that we still have continue to maintain our concerns with regard to CEQA compliance with your environmental review, and those comments we will defer to all of the letters we have submitted thus far.